We set all-time records in the city of New York for ambulance runs. On a typical day, it's about 4,000 runs, and we went through 5,000, 6,000, almost to 7,000 runs a day.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to COVID-19 Heroes. I'm your host, Lorraine Schneider, and today I'm honored to be speaking with Kelly McKinney. Kelly, a longtime emergency management veteran, serves as a senior director of emergency management and enterprise resilience at NYU Langone Health. Living and working in the epicenter of COVID-19, he brings an unparalleled view of the pandemic, how it's been affecting the human experience for New Yorkers, and where it lies in the context of catastrophic disaster response. This episode was recorded on June 4th, 2020. Hi, Kelly. Thank you for being on today's show of COVID-19 Heroes. Welcome.
Thank you, Lorraine. I'm so happy to be here. I really love your show.
You are the author of Moment of Truth, which contains advice for the government and contains practical steps that citizens can take to keep them and their family safe. In it, you use the term black swan. Can you explain this term in the context of disasters and tell us if COVID-19 falls into that category?
Yeah, so I appreciate that as the first question. I'm a catastrophist, and that was really the reason that I wrote that book, was because of my interest in that topic, and I really feel like that's my mission, is to call attention to the threat of catastrophes and our collective sort of unpreparedness for them as a nation. And black swan is really a pretty familiar term that emergency managers use a lot, but technically speaking, it has three characteristics. The first is that it's unpredictable, it's unforeseen before it happens. The second is that it's extreme, it has severe and widespread impacts. And the third is, and this is the interesting part, is that there's a widespread insistence in its aftermath that it was obvious beforehand, right? So those are the three pieces. One is that nobody sees it coming. The second is that it's a big disaster, big widespread disaster. And the third is that those same people who didn't see it coming are the ones who talk about all the things that should have been obvious beforehand. And so I think that this coronavirus pandemic meets all three of those things. So it is a black swan in that context, because even in this country, you know, as the outbreak was raging in central China, there were so many people in the United States talking it away and talking away the job, talking about how China's different. You know, they're heavy smokers over there, or, you know, those guys eat live animals. And we don't eat live animals, and so we're not going to get this pandemic here. And so there was this denial, which, you know, I've seen so many times in my career, that human denial. I call it the brick wall of hope. People can't see beyond it. So even in the weeks, in the run-up to when the pandemic really took hold on the West Coast, people were saying it wasn't going to happen. And then now, in the aftermath, there are so many people saying, you know, that lives were lost because you didn't do the obvious thing in those early days. And to me, you know, we were way in the middle of the job in the early days, and it wasn't obvious to any of the people we were talking to, these steps that were taken. So yeah, long answer to your question is, in my opinion, the COVID-19 pandemic is a black swan.
From 9/11 to Hurricane Sandy, you've really seen it all. What has surprised you the most about COVID-19?
So what we did when we saw this happening in China is what we always do, which is to try to put ourselves in the job. And so we try to put ourselves in Wuhan. There were a lot of social media, a lot of videos coming out of there, a lot of tweets and Instagram posts. And so we tried to immerse ourselves in that, and then in Lombardia in northern Italy after that, to try to understand what we were facing. And we took away, especially from Wuhan, we took away this image of crowds at hospitals, right? That, you know, worried well, we're going to crowd into the hospital. So that was what we prepared for. We prepared for this surge of what we call mild illness and worried well into our hospitals. And we just didn't get that. We didn't get a tsunami of people, because what we missed and what happened and what everybody knows is that government acted very rapidly and very effectively to shut everything down. So I live in New York City, you know, and the difference between New York City in December of 2019 and March of 2020 is just night and day. It became a ghost town overnight, essentially. You know, the streets were empty when they called for lockdown, and they closed the schools, right? And they closed all essential businesses. And it was just eerie. The streets were just quiet. But then, you know, very quickly, the sound of ambulances could be heard, and that increased. And you know, those EMS runs, they just started to climb. And because people were staying home, but they were getting sick, and they got sicker and sicker, and they finally called 911. And so those ambulances brought those coronavirus patients into our emergency departments. They didn't come on their own. And we set all-time records in the city of New York for ambulance runs. We typically, on a typical day, it's about 4,000 runs, and we went through 5,000, 6,000, almost to 7,000 runs a day. And the interesting part is that the normal patient type that you bring in an ambulance, those went away. So people weren't calling because of chest pains. They weren't calling because of all the other reasons. Those people were staying home. And so it became almost a pure flow of coronavirus patients. And that was the job for us. And so we started to fill up and we just transformed our hospitals in real time into coronavirus intensive care units. You know, all of our beds. For about 9 weeks, it was just 24/7 running to try to accommodate that river, essentially. You know, the river was just rising and rising, and we didn't know how high it was going to get. We didn't know if we were going to drown in these patients.
Yeah, and talking with doctors, I know they've been very concerned, knowing that the regular patient type has not been coming over the last couple of months, and what that will mean moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's, you know, that in some ways could be, you know, the disaster behind the disaster, right? Is all those people that are not seeking medical care for conditions that are going to get worse and worse. You know, there was a lot, we weren't doing cancer surgeries. We are now, but, you know, the impacts of that delayed care, those are, I think we're just starting to realize what that is.
So in the face of what is potentially the worst period in many New Yorkers' life, what new things have you learned about the human experience sharing collective trauma and adversity?
As an emergency manager in New York City, it's a tough place in many ways. You know, I got into this business on 9/11. I was the associate commissioner for environmental health at the New York City Health Department downtown on 9/11. And I went to the Emergency Operations Center, and I spent many weeks there. And that was how I got into the business. And, you know, that event defined me. It defined my outlook. It defined my worldview. And that's why I'm a catastrophist. You know, when you're staring up at the World Trade Center and it crumbles before your eyes, you know, your worldview changes to a catastrophic worldview. And that's what happened to me. But even then, you know, we didn't really allow ourselves to feel it and acknowledge those feelings. And I think a lot of first responders and a lot of New Yorkers are still carrying that around. And so now, all these years later, I mean, it's now almost 20 years later, it feels the same in many ways. New York City feels like we're going through the same thing again. And I think that we don't have the tools we need. I mean, there was a thing called Project Liberty after 9/11, where, you know, you could call this number and you could talk to this person and you get a couple of sessions, and then they could refer you to more care and all these kinds of things. And there were, you know, the Red Cross was there with their emotional support people, and they do a terrific job. But I don't think we have collective tools to address the collective trauma that the public is dealing with. And even more than that, in most places, you look to leadership to help you with that. You know, the president says words that promote healing. And that has happened on both sides of the aisle. Republicans and Democrats have, you know, after tragedy, they've spoken words to the American people that have helped them to heal, that have helped them to accept what's happened and begin the healing process. And we do not have that kind of leadership at a national level. In fact, it's just the opposite. I mean, General Mattis yesterday called attention to the fact that we have a president that's really dividing the nation. And I think that is really a problem. I think that is one of our biggest problems right now, because the American people can withstand adversity. New Yorkers can withstand any adversity. I mean, I've seen it. You know, the people that aren't emergency managers, they say, if they talk about, well, here's what would happen in a disaster. Here's what would happen if that calamity occurred. And they always talk about panic, and they always talk about, you know, all these people losing the control, and, you know, running through the streets, waving their arms. And people that have been there, people who have experienced it in New York City and in other places, that doesn't happen. You know, human beings have tremendous resilience themselves. And then collectively, it's just, it cannot be overcome by events. Human beings bind together and they get through it. But this is working against us, you know? And so that's my biggest concern right now. And that's what has to happen, is we have to come together and we can get through anything. But, you know, they say house divided can't stand, cannot stand. And so I just don't know what the future holds for us.
So experiencing such an intense event over such a long period of time, how does one keep a positive outlook, and how did you keep up the morale of your staff?
So for us, it's really about the job. It's about the mission. You know, I have an incredible team here, and I've been in this business 20 years. I've never worked with a better team of people than I'm working with right now. And so it's really about getting to work when you're an emergency manager, and it's about the work and about the mission. And we're in the service business. Emergency management is a service business. We are not incident commanders. We provide coordination. We solve problems. We manage resources. We manage information, all to the benefit of people, right? And so we do that in the midst of disaster. So we're not normal in that respect. We're not normal people. We come from that disaster world. The best emergency managers live there. They exist there because they the more time they spend in the crisis, dealing with all of the chaos there and all of the reverse logic, right, and all of the discontinuities there, the more they're able to bring that knowledge and that expertise to bear when it happens in the normal world. And so the morale here is relatively good, because I think we executed well with this coronavirus outbreak. We did our job, essentially, and that is the thing that gives us the most peace of mind. We did our jobs, right? I would just say that we didn't expect the social unrest issues that we're dealing with now, and that's layering on top of the outbreak for us. So the workload is getting to be sort of a crushing burden, but we're holding it together. And just in terms of the morale of my staff and the morale of emergency managers, I think we have that peace of mind because we're doing a good job. And the other thing I would say is that, you know, we talked about that. I call it the parallel universe, right? There's a parallel universe on the other side of that brick wall in our minds. Everybody's walking around that brick wall of hope, and they don't want to look beyond it to all these bad things that could happen. But beyond it is, you know, is the disaster zone. It's the crisis zone where the normal rules of logic don't apply, you know, and you see things that you never thought you would see, and you do things that you never thought you'd have to do. And all those things that always worked for you suddenly don't work anymore. And the people you relied on are gone. So it's just even sort of, you know, cause and effect just sort of don't apply there. And so we live in both worlds. Emergency managers exist in both worlds, but we're really emissaries from that crisis world, because, you know, we come into this normal world and we talk to normal people about it, and they think we're crazy, right? A lot of things don't make sense. And then when the crisis world happens, everything we've been saying makes total sense. And so an example is all of the things that we told this organization in January of this year about how this outbreak was going to roll out. And everybody said, I don't believe it. These are all the reasons this isn't going to happen. And so every day after day, we'd bring different teams together and put them into that job. And there was a lot of pushback and there was a lot of disagreements and there was a lot of anxiety. But then as it started to happen, all the things we were telling them were going to happen started to make sense. But the thing is that, you know, again, as an emergency manager, we have to be different. We have to have a mindset that allows us to be effective in the midst of chaos. And it isn't a normal mindset because chaos is not normal. So you can't bring, a normal mindset into the disaster zone. You have to bring a disaster mindset that you build up before the job. And part of it is really that voice in your head, right? And so, you know, that for a normal person in January, that voice in the heads of everyone in this organization was saying, hey, you know, this thing isn't going to happen. I mean, you know, those people are different over there. That's China. That's some kind of exotic place. You know, there's not going to be a pandemic. Come on. What is that? That's like movie stuff. That was what the voice in people's head was saying. And meanwhile, the voice in our head was saying, this is going to be bad. You know, you've got to get ready for it. Here's what it's going to look like. You're going to have these crowds at your EDs. You're going to get overwhelmed. You have to do all these things to get ready. So we listen to a different voice. And then in the crisis, it's the same issue, because in the crisis, the normal person's voice does a flip. And the normal person's voice is like, oh my God, this is the end of the world. You know, things are never going to be the same again. This is never going to get better, right? It's just these catastrophic voices in people's heads. And our voice has to turn too. And it has to start saying the opposite. It has to start saying, no, guess what? We're going to get through this. This is going to be okay. We're going to take step one and step two and step three, and we're going to get through it. So we're sort of the anti-normal. You know, because we have to manage that voice in our head, and we have to talk that same thing to people and get them through it.
Yeah, and having talked to several healthcare professionals on this podcast, I've always asked them if they had ever studied or spent much time exercising on a scenario like a pandemic, and the answer was always no. So I think it's also interesting for, you know, us as emergency managers, obviously all we do all day, every day is think about worst case scenarios, yet there is still, I mean, a lot of other people out there don't, even in a public health sphere. So has COVID been the most challenging disaster for you to respond to?
If you asked me that question 2 weeks ago, I would have said no. I would have said that, you know, it has been a very tough road, but I would have put a couple of other disasters ahead of it. I probably would have put 9/11 ahead of it, and I would have put Hurricane Sandy ahead of it. But the last few days, you know, with this overlay of protests and then some, you know, looting and violence, I don't know if my opinion is changing. But I will say, though, I'm completely apolitical. I do support and respect the protesters. And we've been in the middle of those protests, and they're really important what they're doing, and their methods have been very interesting and effective. I think, you know, that there are crowds, they move through the streets, they turn off their location finders, but it's a very impactful event and important. I think it's been very important, and the mission is important, I think, and we admire and respect the mission. But here in New York, what's happened is there are opportunists who see that going on, and they see that, okay, if the police are engaging these crowds, these peaceful crowds, you know, and there's people everywhere, what's to prevent me from, you know, throwing a brick through this window and loading my car up with stuff, and taking it home with me. And that is really where it started to turn south. And that's where it, for us, became more of a job, right? But I'll tell you that the last couple of days, the tactics, the law enforcement tactics have done a lot to reduce the looting in Manhattan anyway. But if the violence continues, you know, on top of the coronavirus outbreak, day in and day out, it's just going to be very challenging.
Combining your decade-long experience in emergency management and your front row seat to conducting crisis response for a pandemic in a hotspot, how do you foresee the path forward for emergency management and public health? What are some opportunities ahead of us, and what may be some challenges?
So that's an excellent question, and that's the most important question that I could ever be asked, because I do think that emergency management is the essential profession, and that we are necessary to save, you know, the future of society in some ways. But I think that we also need to change, and we also need to, you know, advance into the 21st century. We are an immature industry because we're young, relatively young, you know, especially compared to our partners in law enforcement and the fire services. But I think in some ways it's kind of a divided industry. I see it as being like the old guard and sort of the young professionals, right? And the old guard is a lot of, you know, retired first responders and people like that, and that gained proficiency, you know, with through experience. And then a lot of professionals that came up, you know, and were educated and learned, and you know, some of them, there are a lot of folks are EMTs and things like that, but not primarily sort of retired law enforcement and fire services. And so, but I think we have to continue to professionalize this industry. And I think we have to bring modern technology to bear. And the other thing I think we have to do is figure out how to come together better as a nation. And I think coronavirus has exposed the fact that we don't have an ability to come together as a nation to respond to a national disaster. This is a national disaster, and we are not addressing it as a nation. And some of that, I think, is leadership at a national level, but it's also, you know, we emergency managers need to ignore those political boundaries and our own silo walls to come together collectively and understand how we are going to come together as a nation, as an industry of emergency managers, and help to reduce the human suffering during a catastrophe, because I think there are catastrophes in our future, and we as an industry need to be able to get big enough fast enough to manage that.
If one thing is going to come out of COVID, I really hope that it is helping popularize the field of emergency management, helping people see that it exists and what it is that we do. So on that note, Kelly, thank you so very much for speaking with me today and sharing all your insights about how COVID has impacted New York and your organization. And thank you for your leadership.
Lorraine, I think that this the COVID Heroes podcast and all the things you are doing are really helping that. So thank you so much for inviting me. It's been great.
I'd like to close off this episode by thanking Kelly for his leadership within his organization and within our entire profession. Stay well, stay safe. Until next time, I'm your host, Lorraine Schneider.